And as far as sales on the album or the 45s, was there anybody keeping track of how many?
We have no clue as to how many it sold.
No clue.
No clue.
And there was a controversy regarding the Surf and Bird song, correct, with the Rivingtons?
Yeah, and they just gave it away. We could have today, if we would have made any kind of a stink about it and say, you know, this is nothing like the original song, we'll split it with you. They would have done it. But our management was, what would you say, incompetent at best, you know, when we look back at it.
So they were credited as the songwriters.
Right. Yeah, but that's okay because in recent years, it's all, everything goes full circle, you know. We own all of our masters and everything that we've done in the last 20 years, in the last 30 years now, I suppose, has been ours. We've remained friends, you know, the band has. And because we never took ourselves very seriously, and we still get together on holidays and have dinner together. And when we go out on the road, you know, you hear these stories about the bands not getting along and disliking each other. I mean, we go out and we have a good time. I mean, we really do. We eat in some nice restaurants. We just, it's for us, it's like time stood still being on stage with those guys again. And so it's been really a good time.
Now, I understand that you, when Surf and Bird first came out, you played a job out of the country, correct?
We did.
Where was that?
Caracas, Venezuela.
How did that come about?
Jimmy got it for us. We were touring in New York State. Jimmy Thomas, along with a booking agency there, GAC Booking, I think, out of New York City. We flew over to Caracas. We did it every night. We did a show at the Hotel Tamanaco with Barbara McNair, if you remember her. She was in a lot of movies. A beautiful woman and a great singer. And we played their, you know, their big room there every night. And at the time, however, there was a lot of violence in South America. We had one TV show, the Rene show that we did, and we had no clue as to what they were saying. We just waited for Los Trashmen, and we'd start playing. And we played this show and left the TV studio, and the TV studio was blown up 45 minutes after we left. So there was a gunfight outside the Tamanaco Hotel when we were there, bullets flying around, and it was kind of a spooky thing at times.
Did they know Surf and Bird there?
Surf and Bird was the biggest song ever to this day in Venezuela, in South America. It was number one for over 3 months.
I have to ask you this. Did girls scream?
Oh, they did. We were like the Beatles over there. They had a car in the back of the studio and, you know, in the hotel where we were. They had guards on the floors not allowing anybody up there. It was amazing, just like we were big stars.
Had you ever received that treatment in the U.S. anywhere?
No, not like that. Although here in our own hometown, when the Bird came out, there was a lot of that. But it wasn't the idolization, or we weren't idols, you know, back then. I mean, it was a whole different life back then.
Well, you're kind of the first rock band out of the Twin Cities that has a major national hit.
Yeah.
I would have to assume some of the other local bands might have been jealous of you guys.
I don't know if they were. I mean, we were friends with Jim Johnson and the Underbeats. We were good friends with him and Tommy Nystrom. And, you know, we had battles of the bands. Even after the Bird came out, we'd come back and the Underbeats, because that was really something. And people to this day ask me, you know, I mean, you guys, did you ever see each other or anything? We'd have a battle of the bands, and Jimmy and Don Larson and all of us would get together and have pizza after we were done, you know. I mean, we always remain friends to this day.
There was a camaraderie between the bands.
I think there probably was some other bands that maybe, I don't know, that maybe for some reason were envious or whatever. But, you know, when you go on tour and you play that many shows, after the Underbeats and Gregory D and the Avanis and the bands that we knew, you know, that we didn't see any bands because we were on the road all the time. And so all this was happening here, and we really didn't know about it that much. I mean, because we were very seldom here. I knew about the Jokers Wild, you know, because Mike knew them, and I, you know, we did some sessions with Lonnie Knight. back then when Lonnie was playing guitar, and I think he was doing some sessions for Herb Hilhofer, and he was doing soundtracks for commercials and things, you know, so I got to know him that way. Dan Holian, I got to know him. I don't know if you don't remember him, or maybe you do. Great
Midwest.
Really good guitar player. I just saw him about 2 months ago. I hadn't seen him in 40 years. There were bands that we met on the road, the Titans.
From Duluth?
Duluth. And I'm still in contact with Rick Colburn, and I knew all those guys. They played here in town at Duff's downtown. George Johnson was a guitar player, and when he would go out for a weekend with the reserves, he was in the Army, I'd sit in and play with him. So we were friends with a lot of the bands, but mostly the earlier bands, because the other ones, we really never got to know them.
It sure stimulated the record business here in town. While they were out on the road, Surf and Bird got George Garrett inundated with bands coming in from here, there, everywhere, North, South Dakota, Iowa.
Yeah.
Make me a hit. You know, we want to record a hit similar to Surf and Bird. So he came up with some kind of package deal where he'd take them down to K-Bank and 200 Records or whatever the thing was. It was Amos would take a listen at some point if it was generating any noise in town, and take a listen and take it on to distribute if anything was clicking with the records. But he, every time we would go out there, he'd have something. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? You know, because it was hard to tell.
What role did Garrett play in the studio? Did he, like, tell you what to play or how to play? Or
no, he was just pretty much there. That's all. He had smoking and he always had a sweater with a hole in it. I remember that.
Smoking a cigar, yeah, wearing a sweater with a hole in it.
Yeah, you know, and our relationship soured pretty quickly.
Because of financial matters?
You know, I don't know who did it, but we were, you know, kind of making a stick about getting paid, and they said, I got a telephone call, you better keep your doors locked at night. And I said, I'll tell you what, I'll keep them open. Come on over, I'll have a surprise for you.
Who was the caller?
I had no clue, and I just hung up, and that was it. But, you know, there was hard feelings because of it.
So at what time period was there a renewed interest in the Trash Band?
In the 80s. All right, we were playing once in a while in the 70s. We didn't play at all for about 8 or 9 years. And then somebody had a classic rock show they wanted to play, and so they asked us to play. And we hadn't been together playing for about 9 years. And so we got together, and it was like, you know, riding a bike, really. We had played together so much. And so we'd play once in a while. And then the 80s, some of these better shows came about. You know, there was Dave Hoffman, you know, got us into some of these shows with some of the, you know, Jan and Dean and people like that. So we'd play once in a while, and just played like that. Once in a while, gigs that we'd like to play, we got together and played. And we played, you know, downtown. We played in one of the block parties and got to see, for us, we'd get to see Jim Johnson and Don Larson and all these people, you know. That's really the only reason we'd go down and do it, to see all of our old friends that we hadn't seen in a long time.
Oh, at some point you get Surf and Bird into a movie or two?
Yeah, and all of a sudden it's in a movie, and now it's in some commercials and Reebok commercials and things like that. And then Family Guy, you know, came about, and we weren't playing together at all. When Steve passed away, my brother started playing drums, and when we were playing some of these shows.
Your brother is?
Mark Andreessen. And he played with us for 22 years, you know. And so we'd find some show that we liked to play. We'd go and play like a weekend, you know, and do three different rock festivals or something. Mm-hmm. And get a motor home and have a good time and come back. And then we hadn't been playing at all. And Bobby V came back from Europe, and I was talking to him. He said, Tony, he said, you guys are really big in Europe. Did you know that? And I said, I don't know that, Bob. And he said, well, you know, you should call the guys up and see if they want to go over there. I mean, you guys could really have some fun over there and make some good money. So I called Dal. My wife, Barbie, said, you know, Tony, she pushed me to to do it. And so I called Al, and he said, I just love to play. And Bob said the same thing, and my brother said the same thing. So we booked a show, and Eddie Angel was a guy that I know in Nashville. He's a really good guitar player, plays with some groups, different groups now, and it was a studio guy. They were having a festival in Chicago. We hadn't played together in a number of years. And so we went to Chicago. We rehearsed 13 times, went to Chicago, and played this thing, and it was great. What an audience response, you know, doing the bird and everything. So then we had we'll check out Europe, but we got offered a really good one-show deal in Europe in Valencia, Spain, and it sold out. And the money was great, you know. So then we had a six-day booking in Europe, so we went and did that. Well, that was great. And we had another one that was about 17 dates, so we went and did that.
Are
and
you
had,
with other oldies bands? Or
no, just us and their local bands. And Then we had one for 23 dates, and we did that. And it was like time stood still for us, and we had such a good time. We're going back to Valencia, Spain again in February and play there again.
So they obviously know who you are.
Oh, yeah.
And they know
we are. I mean, people stop us on the streets over there and take pictures of us, and it's amazing. In Europe, it's a whole different deal. I mean, they recognize us.
And do they have copies of your 45 or your album?
Yeah. We made a deal with Sundays through Mike. Mike got us introduced to Sundays in 1990, I think it was.
89.
And we were the first name act that they signed. They were just kind of starting out in New York City. One of the best things we ever did. They've been just great to work with. They released a lot of really nice stuff. Their artwork is really good. They pay us. And they've done such a good job for us. We've been with them since 89.
And they've also put out live recordings that you recorded, Mike?
And got us some really good venues that we've played. I mean, we played the Hall of Fame in
New Orleans.
In Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, the
Rock Hall of Fame. And we played, you know, like the House of Blues in New Orleans and place like that that they were instrumental in getting us into with, you know,
the Grind.
Ronnie Spector and all these people, you know, the Las Vegas Grind. That was a lot of fun. Yeah. And they sold a lot of merchandise there too, but they've just been really good to us, and that's one of the best things that we did. And Mike recorded all these recordings that he did way back, and they found out that he had those recordings. And so we said to Mike, you know, hey, go ahead and we'll split it with you. And it's one of the best things that ever happened to us, really. I mean, it kept our name out there. People are still ordering.
And your 45 of Surfenberg came out in England on a bootleg, was it?
No, the most played, was it the most played? It made Billboard. It was number two or three on the Billboard charts in 2010, believe it or not, after 40-some years.
Wow.
There was a campaign on the internet, Facebook, or whatever, to beat out the X Factor on the British charts by buying copies, download copies of Surfin' Bird. I think it got to number three. I don't know how their charts work compared to ours, but through sales, whatever, they got it up to number three. For the end of the year was a December promotion.
Yeah, amazing thing after all this time. And now we've got another thing to litigate.
When that Family Guy show came out.
Oh, wasn't that great?
Did you have any heads up on that?
Sure, we did. Because it was Sundays again that got us that. They were the ones that made the deal, I believe.
Bob Irwin arranged that. He has connections. He's done some work with Sony through the years as a freelance producer, engineer, producer, working on some of their catalog things from the past, and has big city connections, New York. He also lined up the Full Metal Jacket, I believe.
That's right, he did, in the movie.
To have that included. And we were watching the Grammy Awards this year, 2012, and in the background, there comes Surfin' Bird again, another arrangement, last minute, to get it played nationally on the network.
You could, can't is, make this up. You really can't after all this time.
It couldn't be done back in the 60s, in the 63-4, other than Dick Clark. But, yeah, it's happening now. It just, you know, through arrangements with people that know what they're doing, pay the royalties, the proper money.
Yeah, they've been wonderful. And I've received calls from other people that were wondering, because they've signed, I mean, tons, dozens and dozens of big names now Sundays has, and it's become a big operation. But a guy like Dick Dale, you know, what do you think, Tony? I mean, is it they've been good to you? Oh, yeah, Dick, they've been great. You know, you're going to love them, and he loves them.
So after the Family Guy show, was there an immediate impact? What year did the Family Guy show come out?
2008, maybe
eight or nine.
Did you notice an immediate impact?
Yeah, particularly in Europe, it was amazing. I mean, the money was really good for the dates. We were doing really great venues, you know.
And if you don't mind me asking, do the Trashmen make more money now than they did in 64, 65?
Oh, yeah, sure, lots more when that happens. But it's, you know, it's a big nut to crack. I mean, being on the road in Europe right now, it was $1,000 a day to be on the road. That's what our expenses were. So, I mean, you're on the road, you know, 23 days. Your expenses are around $28,000 to $30,000. So you better be making some money. And it's, but even a lot of times we bring our gals with us, you know, and because this is a vacation for us, we go over there, and there's not a lot of money to be made when it's all said and done because of your expenses. They're pretty heavy. But we see every part of Europe that we could see.
When the song first came out, Surfin' Bird, did people do weird bird dances on the dance floor?
They would, sure.
And yeah. Today?
They still do. They still do. I mean, there's in Europe, we've got a big punk following in Europe. We're listed now as one of the big punk bands of all time.
Really?
Yeah, because of the song and the name of the group. And we've taken hundreds of pictures with all kinds of punkers and punk bands over there.
So when you go over there, is it a wide variety of ages?
Yeah, it
sure
is.
All ages?
Sure. Yeah, it is. And lots of younger people. The bird is the word.
So
that's what it is.
So it's really a testament to the power of a hit song.
Sure. We run into so many different things that we know nothing about. People with T-shirts, Trashmen T-shirts. We've never seen them before. We don't get mad. We just are flattered. You know, the only thing that I want is one of them. I want one of those T-shirts.
And I believe you told me on one occasion or several occasions in Europe, when they bring you records to sign, they're bringing you bootlegs.
Yeah, a lot.
That were bootlegged back in the 60s? Or
oh, a lot of them now, too. And there's you can't really track them all down. But these people are so nice. They're so nice to us. You know, we sign them. Except in Germany, there was a guy that had albums. He had like a dozen or dozen and a half albums to sign. They're all boots. He had a pass, backstage pass. And we were going to go on in about, 10 minutes. And he's pulling on my arm, you've got to sign these. Got to sign these now, you know, the whole band. And I said, I'll tell you what, we'll sign them when we're done because we're going to go on in a little bit. We got to go up and play. No, I want you to sign them now. He was real pushy. So I said, well, after when we get done. I still smiled at him. And so we went on, did our show, 90 minutes. He stuck around. He was 90 minutes. He's there. We come down, and now he's really pushy. And just before that, I had talked to Dick Dale, and he said, Tony, I'm just signing two. That's all I'll sign. So this guy was so pushy, I said, you know what? I'll sign two. Oh, no, you're going to sign all of them. And he went on and on. And finally, he was so, Eddie Angel was back in the back room, and anyway, Eddie asked him to leave. You know, he was so bad. But usually we stand outside the place or inside and take pictures and sign posters and things that they have. Usually an hour after the show, we're still signing stuff. In Valencia, Spain, when we first went over there, we were so blown away that there were so many people. The place was sold out. There was probably 300-400 people outside, and they had all these posters that they hadn't used, you know. And so we got a whole bunch of them. We just went outside and stood there, and the cameras are going, and we're signing. And we stood out there for at least an hour signing all these posters that we had. And people hadn't been able to see the show, but they could hear it. They could hear it. And I know the security didn't like it that we were going outside like that, but they were such great fans.
Mike, ever tag along with the band to Europe?
No, I have not.
Why not?
My excuses are weak, whatever they are. My wife's working, or this, that, or the other thing. I can't say I'm working anymore. Yeah, one of these days.
Mike, anything special that sticks out in your mind, Mike, your experiences with the Trashmen over the years that you look back at with fondness? Is there any one particular event that comes to mind for you, Mike?
Oh, they were just so cooperative, allowing me to record them. I remember one time I was able to line up, taking them up to the Sock Center Home School for Girls in 1967, I'm thinking, 66.
Mm-hmm.
66, maybe. They agreed to do a freebie up there for the incarcerated teenage delinquent women, girls, on a Saturday morning before they did a show that night in St. Cloud at the Armory. Tony, take over.
Well, we did it, and it was, we were like superstars there. You know, it was a lot of fun. We would do freebies like that sometimes. Mike was like the fifth Trashman. You know, he wasn't, he was one of the guys that, started with us from the beginning. And so he came to a lot of the gigs we did and traveled with us a lot of the time. Sometimes he'd come in his car. One of us would travel with him, you know. He's one of the boys.
And Tony, how about you? When you look back over this long time period, is there any one particular event that sticks out in your mind as a really good memory?
I mean, the shows that we played, one of the biggest was the Winter Carnival.
Ah.
We played 20,000 people.
That was here in town?
Here in town.
In St. Paul?
Yeah. And lots of national groups on the show. First thing like that we did, I think.
Wasn't that December of 63? Maybe right after The Bird
came out.
Filled the auditorium to capacity and beyond. Bill Deal was the MC.
That's the old St. Paul Auditorium?
I believe so, yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, where the XL now stands.
Playing shows with, I mean, there's things that I remember specifically playing in Chicago with Frankie Avalon, the Safaris, and, some of the groups. I mean, just meeting some of those people. My brother, the first time one of the first times he played with us, maybe the first time, and we had a motorhome playing a show with Jan and Dean, and he had heard about them all of his life. And Dean Torrance came on just walked in the motorhome. Hey, you guys, you got a beer, and sat down with us. And he says, I had no idea. Well, I mean, and he got to meet a lot of those people. So, I mean, you remember things like that. But I think the Winter Carnival was because it was such a shocker. There were so many people.
The number of people?
Yeah. Yeah, we played in this last tours we were on. We played in Berlin, Germany, in a town square. And there was a crowd like that there with a huge erector set kind of stage. In Rostock, Germany, too, we actually played on the same shows as, Springsteen was there doing a show. So, you know, you remember some of those times with fondness. But there are some that stick out more than others.
Tony, Mike, thank you for taking the time to share your experiences in the local music business with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure, believe me.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
The preceding interview was recorded on October 27, 2012, at Sunrise Sound in Rogers, Minnesota, and was produced by Danny Johnson and Tom Campbell. The copyright owner of this interview is MiniPaulMusic.com.
I've got a little A-bone like you never had seen, a way out wheeling type of boss machine. I'm eliminator at all the big name drags. She's a stroke damn boat in a shade so neat, and sitting right next to my bucket seat
is a bank shift hydro in a big shillelagh.
Cobra, Cobra, where have you been? I've been looking all over and I'm back again. My little A-bone just taking to shut you down. But she's a running spoof, she's a running trip, she's got a big surprise for you.
It's a bank shift hydro with a big shillelagh.
Cobra, stingray, what you gonna do when my little A-bone comes a-looking for you? Cobra, stingray, ain't you gonna weep when you see my tail?